Listeners, welcome to our latest broadcast with me, Simon Kew, Head of Market Engagement, and my colleague, David Brooks, who's Head of Policy at Broadstone. This time, we're joined by an extremely special guest, Paul Maynard, who was Pensions Minister, amongst many other things, in the previous government. Welcome, Paul.
Hello there. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to have you along. And I'm very much looking forward to asking you about things that go on behind the scenes that our listeners may not know about. So to kick us off, Paul, most of our listeners will probably know you as our a former pensions minister. And I thought it'd be interesting just to ask, what happens when you're handed the brief? Do you get a phone call? Do you get a tap upon the shoulder? Are you called to number 10? And then how quickly do you sort of find a desk? But what's the process behind it all?
So it's never been the same process twice, if you like. I've been called into number 10 to see Theresa May. I've had a phone call from Boris. I've had a phone call from a chief whip at one point. When you get sacked, it's definitely the prime minister, because Boris did dispense with me before I got reappointed by Rishi. So it does vary. So you never quite know when the phone's going to ring or when it's not going to ring. You know, often those who are really ambitious walk around at reshuffle time with their phone in their hand just in case they miss it ringing and they can feel it buzzing. I, who have much lower expectations, of course, just wait to hear, and I'm always taken by surprise, not least by where I get sent to do a job. And, you know, the moment you get given the offer and you say yes, the Whitehall machine gets into gear, your Secretary of State will probably give you a call. Your permanent secretary will give you a call and you say, well, I'll be in at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. You go into your department, you get greeted, the big photo for the display in the lobby. You meet your new private secretary and you sit down and you go through all your likes and dislikes of, you know, allergies and all the rest of it and, you know, emergency contact numbers. And then maybe, just maybe, you might just start to consider what brief you're actually doing and start to prepare for that. And that's maybe when the harder bit begins, I think.
Yeah, I imagine. Interesting, you mentioned Secretary of State giving you a call. To an outsider, it always appears to me that the Pensions Minister does the work and the Secretary of State gets the credit. Is that kind of like the division of power? Because I guess the Secretary of State has a wider brief. You have a much more targeted one. How does that work?
In the early stages, often when you are appointed, the Secretary of State hasn't yet made his mind up who gets what brief in his department. We'll have a range of junior ministers, and he then has to work out who he slots in where. But you are right in that as pension minister, as a junior minister, you do all the work on the brief, and often the really big stuff gets done by the Secretary of State. That is not a problem. And if it works well, as it always has done with me, I'm in tune with my Secretary of State. I want the Secretary of State to trust me enough to get on with the job. He's not standing over my shoulder saying, check this, do that, you're doing that, Paul, or having special advisors loitering outside your door, petrified you might be about to do the wrong thing. You know, you are self-contained and autonomous and get on with it. And as long as you keep everyone informed, it normally works fine. I never had a problem myself.
Brilliant. Dave, do you want to ask the next one?
I was just interested because when you got the pension minister brief, it wasn't too long after that you had that there was a booking in at the Working Pensions Committee to talk through some quite. I know we can't go into specifics, but you can say whatever you like. Then that's great.
If I recall correctly, I had about a week or so to prepare for a quite technical cross-examination on defined benefit pension reforms and what the government had learned and what they hadn't learned. And on day one, I had learned nothing at all. I had to try and remember what a defined benefit pension actually was. I knew sort of somewhere deep inside. Usually, the moment you get your brief, you get a large stack of PowerPoint presentations and slide deck of here's what you're in charge of. Here's what you need to know. And you have about 3 days of non-stop briefing as various officials parade in your office and out of your office telling you, oh, you're in charge of the Office for Nuclear Regulation. Oh, am I? Why would that be? Oh, you're in charge of short-term maternity grants. Oh, am I? That doesn't sound like pensions at all. So you suddenly discover all the little bits that you're also in charge of, as well as the really big stuff. So it's quite a fascinating few days, but you have those looming appointments in the calendar. You have to start seeing the major stakeholders because they all want to get their eyes on you and see what you're made of. And you know, are you a turnip or might you be some use? Then, as you say, you've got the detailed appearances before the select committee. And depending on who chairs the select committee, they might be nice to you, they might be nasty. Luckily, Stephen Timms is one of the nice guys in British politics, so was very fair, understood, you know, not to go in too hard on me. But I always took the view that your first appearance before the select committee is when you win your brownie points. If you sit there passing every question over to your senior official, you look as though you haven't got a clue what you're talking about. And I've always made a point. So first time I got made a minister, when I got made rail minister, we were in the midst of a rail strike on Southern Rail. And the day after I got made the minister, we had a select committee I simply could not dodge and say, too early for me. And that was a real baptism of fire because I was, you know, I was under pressure. You have to know your stuff. And you have to get up to speed really, really quickly on the brief that you're doing. So it's probably the biggest challenge, I think, of being a minister in the early days is understanding what you're doing and being able to explain it to other people. It's a knack, but it's part of the job.
Yeah.
I remember that appearance, and I did quite like your honesty because naturally they're going to ask questions you don't know the answer to, and there were several questions about timelines, and I think you said at one point, well, it's sooner than that last point but not quite as as quick as the other. It was a paraphrasing, but I thought that was a wonderfully honest answer rather than just sort of coming out with some nonsense or batting it away. I found that quite refreshing, actually.
And I think in terms of those questions, you're at such an early stage, you simply don't know how long it will take your officials to do anything in the first place. And, you know, there are certain civil service phrases I hate, which sort of basically tell you the timing. You know, so if someone says, oh, we'll do that in due course, that means it will never happen. Imminently means I've already signed off the press release, but you'll just have to wait your hurry. And then there's various gradations in between that many on the commission will know what you mean as well as you know what you mean. So there's a certain language that has to get deployed.
Very yes, minister.
Yeah, oh, very much so. Yes, minister is a documentary, as they always say, not a comedy show.
So, Dave, Work and Pension Select Committee, we noted that Paul was on the Work and Pension Select Committee earlier in his parliamentary career. How was it being on the other side of that?
Interesting in that you are always going to get one or two members of it who are pension nerds. And on day one, they are going to know far, far, far more than you do. And you're not quite sure whether what they're saying is actually of any use or not. So you have to be respectful, not dismissive. Nod sagely. It's very important to nod sagely and just let them burble on. Often they are so enthusiastic about pensions, they will talk for 5 minutes without asking a question. Just let them do it. Run the clock down. Why do you have to be the one to talk all the time? Let them have their say and just say, it's really interesting. I'll take that away and think about it. Thank you. I think there are some things where you know the answer. There's a distinct government policy and you've already understood it and you can relay it. If someone says, well, I've had an interesting idea. What do you think of this? I probably think nothing at all at that stage because I've been focusing on the questions I know are coming my way. So playing a select committee as a minister, probably one of the hardest things you have to do, but also one of the most important. And it's where colleagues can tell, does the minister know their brief? And many of the time I've sat on the other side of a select committee and thought, this minister doesn't know their brief. So I always know that I've got to step up to the plate.
That's good. I mean, we touched on policy, and I know there are COBRA rules, so we're not going to put you in an awkward position. But are there any things that you were very pleased that you got through or kicked off, or things that you're frustrated that you couldn't get through? And just generally, where do you think we are now policy-wise? There's plenty in the press at the moment, of course, with pensions reviews and things like that. So how do you see the landscape? I know you've posted a few very interesting posts on LinkedIn regarding some of this.
I have to really try and myself from issuing running commentaries on everything I read in the Times each morning. It's not good for my health, I suspect. The consequence of having a pensions minister sitting in the Treasury, occasionally making a day trip once a month down the road to DWP just to check it's still there, I don't think has been helpful for pension policy at all. And I've been trying to think, what are their talking points on pensions? What have they got left to say? Reviews have been and gone. There's no long-term attempt to work out what we want our pension system to do now. It's all about short-term economic growth. And many of the ideas that they're coming up with may be sound. They may be echoes of what I was planning to do alongside the Treasury, but they are over-exaggerating the impact they will have on the economy, both in the short term and the long term. So we just had, as part of Rachel Reeves' growth speech, around surplus distribution. Now, that's been quite controversial when I've done roundtables, a lot of nervousness around it, that it might in some way imperil the viability of a pension fund. I had no real fundamental objection, but I was interested in the fact that it would be trustees making those decisions, and a trustee might want to try out a new asset class and you know, try to grow the fund. They might want to actually not do so for the benefit of members. They might even want to reinvest in the business, because the best way to guarantee a member's rights and a guaranteed pension is to make sure that the company is healthy and profitable. Because if it goes into bankruptcy, if it goes into administration and you're in the PPF, you won't get as much as you would have done if your scheme had been healthy. So there were all sorts of options that trustees would have. And I found it strange listening to her on Monday that there was a presumption almost that the moment you gave this option to pension fund trustees, they would all run like Gadarene swine to invest in the British economy. And some might. But then the proportion, I think, will be relatively small, at least in the early stages. The difference it will make to her growth agenda overall will be infinitesimally small. And you can't guarantee that they will, if they are going to go and invest in new asset classes, that they will be ones that benefit the British economy as opposed to the overseas economy. There seems to be this continual reluctance to acknowledge that pension scheme trustees must always act in the best interest of their members. And that might be an annoyance to the government, but it is the reality. And it isn't just this academic point around, you know, how wonderful our trustees are. This is about pension scheme members who've saved all their lives being confident that they will get back what they have paid in, and that it will not be placed at risk at the service of the wider political goals of the government. So I do find it quite frustrating that the detail is not necessarily going to be problematic, but they are not selling it correctly. They are exaggerating the impact it's likely to have. You know, they always say, under promise, over deliver. This seems to be the alternative way around in doing it, which I don't think they're doing themselves any favours, because it's a perfectly good reform agenda. They need to hurry up on it. Are we going to see a pensions bill? I have no idea. Occasionally I get told we will, and then I get told we won't. Who knows? But there's so much that needs doing. With no stage two pension review, the really big issues are simply not even being thought about. And that's, I think, the great sadness. A new government is an opportunity. Whatever you think of the politics of that new government, they've got momentum to do things. The clock is not being run down anymore. They had a great chance. We're 6 months in, and even their limited initiatives have ground to a halt already in terms of what the long-term vision for pensions are. So it should, in many ways, be quite depressing.
You made a really good point there, Paul, and it's something that Dave and I have said in our weekly podcast and other things. The focus has to be the member. It's these people that are expecting their pension. that's, it's always got to come back to that. And that, yeah, the trustees have got their fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the beneficiaries. So finding a way to get them to either release a surplus or to invest in UK asset classes, there's got to be the right asset class. They've got to know that they're going to get some sort of return on it. And I think where we're missing some detail is what are these assets going to look like? There's certainly conversations that that I've had with other people as well. But hopefully we will see that detail in sort of coming consultations around, I mean, adequacy, for instance, is due out. But yeah, it's certainly interesting. I mean, look, it's headline news, pensions, isn't it? So
well, it ought to be. It ought to be, given just how many people are. You know, it affects all of us sooner or later. So, you know, it ought to actually be much higher up the political agenda than it is in terms of decisions that are not taken. You know, I always think auto enrollment is a dog that doesn't bark on the media.
Yeah, and I think, yeah. I mean, I take your points, Paul, about the dwindling number of schemes, especially DB schemes, that will do the government's bidding in this, you know, space of productive investments. Actually, just keying off that point about pensions in the press and pensions being something to talk about, we had Martin Lewis this week doing one of his
indeed,
shows,
yes,
on pensions, yes, which are always really good. I think he got the most market share for TV at that time, 20%.
He always does.
Yeah, and I think there should be a lot more pensions content, because one of the more depressing things you get when he does those shows, you look through Twitter or X or whatever it's called, in Blue Sky and others, you know, and see the comments and people, and there's so much confusion around pensions, people conflating state pensions, and people get more, people seem to remember the bad headlines from like Maxwell or something like that from like 40 years ago, nearly 30 plus years ago, and you're thinking, you know, the world has moved on, and the government has got some things in train, things that probably you started, VFM, you know, type initiative and these sorts of things, which I do think will lead to better things for people. And it just feels like we need to sort of, and that adequacy review would have been good to have, like you say, would have been good to have got some progress with it. I'm a bit in the camp of, I don't mind it being delayed a little bit, but that's more for, you know, what I think might end up coming out with, rather than a political, you know, initiative or what's the word, momentum point. But I do think we do need to see more good news coming out around pensions, rather than the sort of headlines of it's going to solve society's problems and the government's growth problems, which it won't, or it's going to give people an adequate retirement, which it probably won't, you know, all these sorts of things. It'd be nice to sort of try and talk positively about pensions.
You want people to be confident about their pension, about what will happen in their old age. You want them to understand what their own personal situation is. And, you know, being pension confident, as I've heard it described, is really important. Most people simply are not. And, you know, I, typical middle-class person that I am, I read the Times on a Saturday, read the money section, open the pages, and very often, you know, if you want a happy retirement, you need £600,000 or whatever, some vast amount of money that, you know, like most people, I think, well, good Lord, where would I gather that from? And actually, if you think about it, start adding your assets together, you know, they probably come to more than you might realise. But that narrative of, here's an unfeasibly large amount of money that you've been told you need to have, rather than a, you know, you're going to get £10,000 a year with your state pension come what may, if you're fully paid in. You know, people need to be talked through and not put off engaging with the pension, because they think, oh, that's just, you know, I'm never going to manage that. That's not going to happen to me. And then they switch off, rather than finding out what can I do here and there. A little bit of saving, even a little bit every month, really builds up whatever point you start. So I think it's that we need to make people more confident. And that's why government has a role to play, I do think, is in just guiding people along and making sure that no one gets left behind.
Well, I was disappointed this week because Standard Life CEO was stepping down. Now, I wasn't particularly disappointed about that. I don't know him. I'm sure he's done a great job. But he was in his closing remarks, he was saying that there's 17 million people that won't save as much as the PLSA retirement standards minimum. Their minimum is £14,000 after tax. And like you say, the state pension is, you know, pushing £12,000 a year straight away. So those sorts of headlines don't help. I understand Standard Life want people to be saving to pensions because they think that's great and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But to say things that are so negative, I just feel like it's not actually helpful. It doesn't actually frame the debate in a very productive way, just saying 17 million people aren't saving enough to meet the minimum standard, because that's just not, probably not true.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that, I might edit that out. But it probably, but it's probably not that bad. So it's just kind of the bad news stuff. Like you're saying, you know, you need 600,000. Well, you probably don't. It depends on what your income needs are when you get there. It depends on your own circumstances and what your lifestyle would like to be. You know, all these kind of things. You know, having standards sometimes just gets a bit confusing. So maybe we do need government to step in a bit more and do more with Money Helper and, you know, Pension Wise and these kind of things, these initiatives to actually help the conversation, you know, in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. I would agree entirely.
Sorry, I've gone on a bit of a rant. Simon, bring us back. Bring us back to
something. I love a good rant. I'm a politician. I was a politician, not anymore.
You've taken the man out of Parliament. Earlier, we touched on, Paul, when you get the brief and you get the industry bigwigs want to get time with you, and how does that work? I mean, lobbying, do you think that's a good thing? Is it a pain in the backside when you're minister? I know you need to sort of get a wide range of views to help form an opinion, of course, but I mean, even I tried doing it, so and I wasn't successful, I'm sorry to say. But just people wanting to get time with you, how much of a help or hindrance is that?
So I'm one of those ministers who likes meeting as many people as possible. Not every minister falls into that category. You tend to get, in your early days, a list of these are the people you must meet, pre-selected as being the most important ones. And some of them are really very interesting. Others had nothing at all to say. And I thought, why have you been brought in for 45 minutes of my time? Because I'm starting to talk about biscuits. And that's normally a sign that that has not been a good meeting. And often I like to see people who don't normally come into the department, who aren't normally engaging with officials, just to see what they have to say. I trialled a new idea that was a shock to the department, of having what I called Thursday morning tea clubs, where we would get three or four people in at the same time, where they could just all chat amongst each other, change, you know, float ideas around. I'd listen in, and then you're cramming more people in that you've got to see than if you just have a one-to-one meeting. So the more the merrier. But getting access to a minister is a real art, because the invitations or the requests will come into your correspondence pile. The only time you will see them is the point at which the officials are recommending rejection or whatever. So there's quite a long delay between you thinking, oh, I've asked to see the minister, and then 4 months later you might get a rejection, because it's such a slow process. So as a minister, you really got to want to wrestle with your diary. I want to see this person, get them in next week. And, you know, most of the time your private office are fully on board with this and work with the department to make it happen. But pensions was that bit harder, say, than aviation or rail, where all the operators you needed to see anyway, because they were delivering the service on your behalf. Pensions being a much more commercial side of things. If you don't see X, then Y, Z, A, B, and C will all kick off. So my round tables are so great. Everybody gets 10 seconds.
Yeah. I like the idea of the tea club. I think that's very, very good. It helps people let their guard down. Because I imagine when people come in, they could be quite nervous or a little overawed, or if they've never spoken with a minister or never set foot in a department building or something like that, they could probably be quite nervous and I don't know, maybe say the wrong thing.
Maybe it's just me, but the moment they're walking with me, I don't find that's a problem, because I'm fairly down to earth and fairly relaxed about it. I don't, you know, there's no great ceremony. Some ministers insist on being called minister by their civil servant. And who, minister? Minister, I ban that. They either call me Paul or call me rude names behind my back. I don't mind which, but, you can walk into some ministerial offices. There's a union jack there. There's, you know, it's all very formal. Mine was never that formal, I have to say. And that put people at ease. You want them there because you want to have a meaningful discussion with them. You want to hear what they have to say. You want to leave that meeting having gained something yourself, not just ticked a box for that so-and-so we've now seen, right, you know, 9 months before we have to put up with them again. You know, it's there to get information, that an angle that you might not get from your officials. I mean, it's the right angle or the wrong angle. It's a different angle. And I'm particularly always made a point of trying to find the people I liked and got on with, who would tell me the unvarnished truth behind the scenes. Yeah. You know, Paul, why the hell are you doing that? Do you know what you're doing? You know, come on. I know you might have been told X by the department, but, you know, why is really the situation? Then you can start to gently challenge within the department, just to say, why exactly are we doing that? You know, are you sure that's going to achieve what you want it to achieve? Have you thought, you know, why have you rejected this alternative idea? And so part of the skill of a minister is supporting your department and your officials on doing what needs to be done, but also just saying, I think we need to do a bit more here, or I think you need to challenge this particular organisation there, because that's really, otherwise you're just transacting pieces of paper across your desk. You're not adding any value to what you're doing as a minister.
I find that fascinating. We mentioned earlier, is there a bill, is there not a bill? My latest understanding is we're looking at a pension schemes bill coming. Can you just talk us through how does that come about? So I guess, I mean, government department will go, OK, we need to enact this, so there needs to be a bill. But how does it actually work behind the scenes? How does it come about?
Well, lots of departments need to enact lots of things, and they all want to do it at the same time. And there is never enough time in the Westminster diary to fit every piece of legislation in. So government departments have to bid for slots in Parliament. And it may sometimes be that your pet bill is never going to be important enough to squeeze in. You know, it might not be the most important in the department's list. There might be more politically important things to do. So you got to fight for your bill, get it on the schedule, get it in the Queen's speech. That is never a given. You know, let's be clear. So if someone in the sector says, oh, yeah, you're definitely having a bill, really, the final decision is the chief whip in the whip's office. And I've seen how that works. And it is a brutal selection procedure, I have to say. But once you do get your bill in the Queen's speech, you need to let your officials get on with drafting it properly. You know, most of us are not lawyers who are ministers. You know, we take on trust that what's drafted for us will actually do what we intended to do. But the nearer you get to the start of the parliamentary process of second reading is usually when it begins, that you start to really begin to try to understand the nitty-gritty of the legislation. And the more complicated it is, the more you've got to pay attention, because you know you're going to be in committee sooner or later, where every little comma, full stop, subclause will get, you know, worked over ad infinitum, and you've really got to know your stuff. So once again, that's another area where ministers have to be on top of their brief. And all too often you find that isn't, not all too often, that's not over to say. Occasionally I have encountered a minister who has clearly not been on top of their particular brief and hasn't done the legislation justice. And let me just be clear, that's only one or two occasions. I wouldn't want to suggest that all government ministers are useless, whatever party they are.
No, sure not. I think our listeners probably wouldn't have realised quite how much of a fight it is to get the bill in front of, well, Queen's Speech, King's Speech, as is now, of course. Yeah. I still fall into that. I called someone a QC the other day and was promptly corrected. You touched on whips, and I mean, I think most of us outside of Parliament would see that as sort of the dark arts within Parliament. Can you give us a bit of an insight? How does that work? We hear about three-line whip, and I certainly use that phrase quite regularly. But what does go on behind the scenes, if you can tell us?
So they always say that what happens in the whip's office should stay in the whip's office, and maybe some of the details should. But when you say that, it makes it sound like there's all sorts of evil, nasty things going on. And that really isn't the way it is. Each whip will get about 20 MPs that they look after, and the government department that they look after in terms of business in Parliament. you know, you're often there to be part social worker, part attendance monitor, part, you know, liaison. You know, if an MP is unhappy with a particular aspect of government policy, you try to resolve that concern. You know, you don't want it to become a problem. If someone's got family issues that mean they're struggling to attend, that's when you step in and just try to, you know, offer some help, you know, a shoulder to cry on and so on. So that's your pastoral role, if you like. But then also when you are a departmental whip, it's your job to get the legislation through. You've got to be the one confident that it's ready to go, that the minister knows what they're going to be talking about, that there are no banana skins to slip up on, how controversial it might be, for example, you know, is your own side fully behind it? So you're the political brain making sure that things get through. So with the pension schemes bill, I imagine it should be broadly uncontroversial, technocratic, and that probably would favour it getting into a King's Speech. Because it can be got through relatively quickly. You only have so much room, though, for really controversial big stuff that it's going to be a straw on the floor of the House. And they're harder to manage and need much more careful management. And maybe if there's loads of those that are politically utterly essential, the smaller stuff does get squeezed out.
Mm. No, very interesting. And I and others probably didn't realise that sort of parochial element to the whip's office. I think there's probably an assumption that it is just the sort of Machiavellian whipping behind the scenes, not literally, but sort of tongue-lashing whipping going on. But no, that's interesting to hear. Did you enjoy your time in the whip's office, Paul?
Oh, God, yes. It's the only team in Westminster. I know that might sound odd, but most of the time you're working in isolation. Mm. And here you are, all crowded into one office, all dealing with the same issues, the same challenges, the same problems. I was there at the height of trying to get Theresa May's Brexit deal over the line. It was an absolute, I will never forget it, you know, and you make friends for life doing so. And it was incredibly stressful, but also maybe not rewarding because it didn't get the outcome you wanted. But it was a real interesting, fascinating front seat that, you know, as history being made. So I found it fascinating. And it isn't about shouting and pointing at people. It's about listening. You know, so if I had people who weren't happy with the deal, I was trying to understand why. Was there someone I could go and send to speak to who might resolve some of their concerns? Did it need the Prime Minister to have a cup of tea with them? Or were they so fundamentally opposed that really I was wasting my breath and, you know, I should spend my time on those who were more open to persuasion? So it's understanding and listening and trying to work out how do I get enough people over the line to back this piece of legislation. 9 times out of 10, it's not difficult at all. Brexit being one area where it was difficult.
Yes, and we best leave that topic there, otherwise we could go on for another hour.
Indeed.
We'll just start drilling down into different things. Paul, it's been great to have you on. One thing I'd like to ask, I mean, you've now left Parliament. The electorate decided that you would. That wasn't a decision you took. Firstly, how did you find that? And I imagine it's not particularly pleasant. And what are you doing now? What's next for you?
Well, I certainly saw it coming. So it was not the greatest shock of election night. It was not up there with Liz Truss hiding in the car, having lost her 26,000 majority. I was in a marginal seat. My seat, when there is a Labour government, has a Labour MP. So I very much saw it coming. Civilization does not end the moment that you cease to be an MP. For some people, you know, who are so emotionally attached there, they can't imagine life outside it. Yeah, it is a big challenge. For me, there was a degree of relief because it had begun to get very unpleasant, remorseless, relentless. I loved being a minister. I began to find Parliament a less attractive place to be. So a few, you know, months of recuperation and rest and recharging your batteries was absolutely essential whilst I worked out what I wanted to do in my life. And everyone tells you that you will not be walking into a highly paid job a week after Unless you are Rishi Sunak, Michael Gove, Nadeem Zahawi, or those who already have millions of pounds of money, and little old me sitting up in Blackpool, that's not going to happen. And you have to work at it, you know. So I decided I took quite a drastic step that I decided to do an MA in International Military History at Lancaster University up the road, because I wanted an intellectual challenge that was entirely different. I had an itch that I had to scratch with regard to academia. So I'm deep in the midst of that at the moment, wrestling with essay deadlines. It's going back 30 years to my undergraduate days, but I'm loving it, absolutely. But I keep, you know, having conversations, looking for some paid work, which comes along now and again. But hopefully, you know, at some point, I want to move towards maybe not necessarily having a 9-to-5 job in London or anything like that, but where my ministerial experience, my expertise in the areas I've been minister for, where I, you know, I know my brief, I know what I'm saying, I know what I'm doing, where that can add value to the work of an organisation. So anyone like that, I'm always open to conversations, I have to say. But, you know, it's, I want job satisfaction where I can add some value. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I trudge in 9-to-5 yet again, but it does mean that I, you know, I've got skills that I want to make use of. And I think many people out there don't understand what an MP has to do. They don't understand what a minister has to do. Can't distinguish between a good minister and an appalling minister. So it's very hard to get across that skill set. And you have to keep the showcase, you know, demonstrating what it is you can do and your enthusiasm and your interest. So, you know, it's not easy, because I don't think that ex-Conservative MPs have the greatest reputation after the past few years. But my own view is the longer it goes on and the more they see the current operation, the more they think, actually, you know, they weren't that bad, really, were they?
Thank you, Paul. I think we'll leave it there. I think that's been absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
And listeners, thank you for joining us as well. We do hope you enjoyed that. Please, as always, do feedback. Let us know what you thought. And we'll see you for the next broadcast. But thank you all very much.